Fusese. He's a Solomon. 18-1. This is a good one. So this is something I think, like I should say, yeah, this one's like, okay. Tendency of all people, I think, males specifically, I think, struggle with this more than probably our female counterparts. 18-1.
The man who isolates himself from his own desires, he rages against all wise judgment.
All right. He who separates himself seeks his own desire. What's the idea there? Why does someone withdraw from community, withdraw from friendships, withdraw from people in their lives?
They're trying to hide something.
Yeah, often it's a sign of, man, there's something going on within that I don't want exposed, and I don't want to be around other godly people in my life that maybe are going to lovingly bring that to the surface. It's a marker in people's lives, and it's not always the case with this if someone's isolated, but it's often the case when we withdraw from other godly human beings. Often there's a reason for it, right? So that we can live kind of in our own reality. We can seek our own desire and quarrel against all sound wisdom. We don't want wisdom spoken into our lives. We don't want rebuke. We don't want sharpening. And as a result, we say, man, this is the life I'm going to live, right? And it's maybe specifically in some of your seasons of life, those of you that are younger, you can see it plain as day in some situations. You ever been running with a group of guys or gals, and all of a sudden said gal hooks up with some girl, and it's like, that may not be the healthiest relationship. And all of a sudden you look up and you're like, dude, where's so-and-so? We haven't seen him in forever. He's been hanging out with, you know, Beatrice like 24/7. And all of a sudden you call him, he's unavailable, and you want to hang out, he's unavailable, you want to do stuff with the guy, he's just gone. And lo and behold, one of the reasons he's gone, though, is because, man, that relationship's not healthy, and there's maybe things going on that, man, he doesn't want exposed to everyone around him. So as you guys think through your lives, and you think through the lives and the people around you, make sure you surround yourselves with godly men and godly women that are able to do that, right? We all isolate ourselves or have a tendency or desire to do that when we're in sin. See also Adam, thank you very much. I've sinned, find a bush, run and hide. That is our innate desire, okay? One of the qualities that I see in David that I really appreciate, when his life gets hard and when his life gets ugly, he is going to run to people, not away from people, okay? Maybe to a fault in David's life, a guy who's probably a very high harmonizer and people person, but he does not withdraw as best he can. Okay, he moves toward the people in his life that he knows and trusts the most and doesn't withdraw. Okay, so if you see on the signpost of life this quality in you, as you look up and you're moving through life and realize, man, there is no one around me that has permission to speak into my world, there's no one around me that I trust and that I'm sharing at a deeper level with, that's not a good quality. Okay. And if you see that in those around you that you love, that should be a warning sign as well, okay? So just know, I think especially as dudes, we wrestle with this. Gals, I'm sure you do it as well, but gals with their probably higher relational aptitude at some degree tend to do a better job than this in others. So, you guys are characters over there. Any great commentary? You're not, I just wanna know, like if it's, you know, we need all the laughter we can get at 6:02 in the morning. Not godly at all. Okay. Don't ruin it. Don't ruin it. We're not there yet. So, yeah. Spoiler alert. He's gonna sin. He's gonna murder a guy. I don't even want to read it. It is part of the depressing part about going through the same stories every year. Like you really hope they end differently, and they don't. Like all 12 years. Joab's still an idiot at the end of it, and I can't figure it out why. I don't want to like Abner. But at the end I do, but I think he's a turd, and then all of a sudden he's great. David's a goon, and you're like, golly, man, come on. So, but yeah, so it always ends the same. So that is the beauty of saying the same thing over and over and over. So, all right, well, with that, let's go to 1 Sam. And I want you guys to think about something as we're kind of approaching David's life. I want you to think about it in terms of if you were to graph his life, right, if you were to stick his, I don't know, his life on the good, the bad, and whatever. As we meet David, you know, how are we initially introduced to him? Give me where is he in the pecking order of life?
Doing a girl's job.
he's doing a girl's job, so thank you for saying that tongue-in-cheek. Yeah, so I mean, he's got a pretty lowly occupation, right? Is he important in the eyes of people? Not really. He's kind of unknown. He's a Bethlehemite. His daddy's Jesse. Good chance that he's probably the result of wedlock, or his wife, or his mom, rather, having an affair. So, I mean, he doesn't start great. So, I mean, as you think about how we are maybe introduced to David, that's probably him in, you know, 1 Sam 16, okay? Now, how do things go from there?
Up,
yeah, right? So he gets anointed king. I mean, that doesn't stink. So he meets Samuel. He gets anointed. Right? And then he goes back to work, but he's, you know, he's king. Stephen, stop laughing at my handwriting. That's not nice. How about after that?
Beats Goliath.
Yeah, beats Goliath. I mean, that's a fairly big deal, right? We're going to see this morning. They write songs about David after his victory. He is a big freaking deal. So 1 Sam 17, right? We get David and Goliath. We see this victory. He's becoming much in the eyes of the people around him. Okay, David's life at the beginning is going to be a rocket ship, like straight north. It is amazing. Okay, and again, when we meet him, he's a young guy. He defeats Goliath. What did we say yesterday? 13, 14 years old. He is a young guy. Now, tell me, do you think this trajectory is consistent with the type of people that God tends to use? Do you think that David is just going to have this rocket ship ride to the moon, Saul's going to die, he's going to take over the kingdom, and David's never going to have like a big dip? No. Like, that is just inconsistent with how God works. Now, do you see anything in David right now that you go, man, that's sin, that's questionable, that needs to be refined? Like, at this point, there's not a whole lot that you can say, you know, have against him. But this is very, very rarely the type of graph that God uses in the lives of people that he's going to use for his purposes, right? We always see difficulty. So I want you to remember that. As we approach this morning, the difficult season in David's life, that is part of the recipe that God uses. I would say probably 99.5% of the time. You get it. You get your Nehemiahs every now and again. You get your Josephs that still go through a ton of hardship. But there are very few people, as you can trace back their life and say, yeah, I just don't see difficulty, struggle, circumstances that are hard, sin issues that have to get kind of worked through and refined with God. That just isn't how God works, okay? And as you look through this, a lot of this just kind of happens to David. It's not necessarily his fault. It's just the reality of what it is. So as you think through this, we're going to get to here this morning, okay? And then it's going to turn, and we'll see this mark very clearly in the text, all right? So with that, we finished David and Goliath yesterday, so let's get into 1 Sam chapter 18. Josue, we pray for us, my friend, and then we will dive into the text.
Thank you, Lord, for this morning, that we can study your word, God, and that we can spend some time meditating on David and his life, Lord, that we can find ways, Lord, that you can mold our hearts, or that you can mold our affections towards you, Lord. I pray, God, that you help us throughout the day, Lord, to bring glory to you, and that we can just edify each other throughout the weekend and the coming months.
Amen. Thanks, man. All right, now, see this big victory from David. Obviously, through the story of David and Goliath in chapter 17, we spent a good deal of time on yesterday. In 18 now, we're going to move to David and Jonathan. And really, 18 through 20 is a picture of David and Jonathan's relationship, along with his relationship, David, with Saul. Okay, so we're going to see that unfold before us. All right, now, this is a unique relationship that these two guys have. 18, verse 1. Let's pick up there and kind of see how these two guys interact.
Now, when he had finished speaking to Saul, the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul. Saul took him that day and would not let him go home to his father's house anymore.
All right, so we're seeing now a change in David's job with Saul, right? He's no longer back and forth from Bethlehem tending sheep. It's like, nope, you're on my full-time staff. Now, why would Saul do that? At this point, what is he seeing in David?
Threat?
Not yet. But that's coming. We're verses away. What's that?
Potential,
for sure, right? And man, you're a warrior. Yeah, you're young, but boy, Saul's a smart guy. Like, let's bring this guy in. He's brilliant, and he's Midas at this point, right? He just defeated Goliath. He's favorable to the people, okay? What are you noticing in verse 18:1 with David and Jonathan's friendship? Yeah, you say that tongue-in-cheek, but man, I sat in a classroom at the University of North Texas underneath a female priest who taught that David and Jonathan were actually gay. They were lovers, espoused kind of this theory, walked through their relationship, and then took it as far to say that Jesus Christ also was gay. And the point of that whole deal was to espouse her theology of God does not condemn that. It's condemned in the Old Testament. In the New Testament, homosexual relationships are fine and okay in the eyes of God. So there is a uniqueness to their friendship. Now, I do want you guys to read this with all seriousness. They have a very unique friendship. It is healthy, it is right, and it is good. Okay, there is deep affection between these two men for one another. Again, Jonathan is 13 years older than David. So this isn't buddy-buddy. This is mentor mentee, okay? So just want you to read it through those lenses. Somebody had a hand up over here. No? Okay. All right, so you're seeing these two guys. Now, obviously, there's some history here between the two of them that we don't see. Jonathan, obviously, has been around Saul's kingdom. He's been around David as a result of this anointing and obviously him fighting Goliath. He knows who this guy is, and they are knit together very, very quickly, okay? Verse 3 now, this is significant. All right, so verse 3. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Now, knowing what you know about covenants, why is this language significant? What's that? It is a lifetime covenant promise, okay? Who initiates said covenant? Jonathan, okay? The older, the more powerful, the prince of Israel, initiates this covenant with David, okay? We don't get the details of that covenant here, but we will, okay? Why is this significant, and why is the picture in verse 4 significant? What does that mean? He took off his robe, gave it to David, his armor, his sword, his bow, and his belt. What does he just do with his stuff? Yeah, and in a step further than that, what is, again, Jonathan's future in terms of the lineage of kings? What's waiting for him? A crown, a throne, right? He is basically dethroning himself, taking off his royal garments and putting them on David. So what statement is he making here? Yeah, you're the next king. So what happened in 1 Samuel 16 in Bethlehem through Samuel, I believe that. I trust that. You are the guy. You're 13 years old. I'm 26 at this point. I believe in you, right? You are a seventh grader, an eighth grader, and I am taking off my garments as a seasoned military man, a leader of my father's army, the next king in line, and I'm saying I'm putting my faith and my trust in you, okay? This is a significant statement, okay? This isn't prompted per se. This is done out of Jonathan's goodness of his own heart. Now, he sees the handwriting on the wall, too, that we'll get to this morning as well. But this guy initiates that. Okay, he has the power. And you're going to see that Jonathan is going to have the role of when David hits difficulty, he is a guy that believes in David through and through. He trusts him, and he is the wind kind of in his sails when David's life is upside down. Okay. This action is significant, and it very clearly states where Jonathan believes his future is heading and where David's future is heading. Okay? Make sense? So Keep that in the back of your mind, all right? We'll see this language repeated, the story repeated several times, all right? Now, verse 5, back on the rocket ship.
So David went out where Saul sent him and behaved wisely, and Saul sent him over the men of war, and he was accepted into the sight of all the people and also into the sight of Saul's servants. Now it happened as they were coming home when David was returning from the slaughter of the Philistines that the women had come out of all the cities of Israel singing and dancing to meet King Saul with tambourines, with joy, and with musical instruments.
All right, verse 5. Tell me something about this. Is a statement over maybe a period of weeks, months for sure, maybe a year. What's going on with David underneath Saul? Dude, and how is he as a general? Everything he does turns to gold. Everywhere Saul says, go deal with that skirmish, go deal with that uprising, I need you to go take care of the Philistines and lead this band of men, he is nails. He is faithful. He prospers. Now, was Saul brilliant, right, to bring him on his staff? Is that exactly what Saul was hoping for? Absolutely. I need a guy that can handle this. It's handled, right? So he is, he's energizing the people. They're no longer losing land to the degree that they were before. He prospers everywhere he goes. And notice, how does David do underneath Saul in terms of that relationship? He's obedient. He's submissive to authority. Does he deal well with authority in his life? Yeah. Is he the next king? You bet he is. Does he realize in this station of life, God, that's not where you have for me yet, so I'm going to prosper here. I'm going to be faithful. Yes, I didn't come here to be the armor bearer or the harp player, but Lord, that's the lot you have for me. Great. I'm going to do it nails, and I'm going to make my boss look amazing. And that's exactly what he's doing. Okay. Now, as David goes out to battle and these stories repeat, the people are hearing about that, and they literally come out and sing. And this is in verse 7, the song that they sing about David and Saul.
So the women sang and danced and said, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000.
Ooh. How did that strike Saul, would you guess? Saul has slain his thousands, but David is 10,000, right? Saul's great. He's fantastic. But David, he's above and beyond. How do you think that would strike a guy like Saul? Not so good, right? There's some jealousy there, and you see it in verse 8. Look at this.
Then Saul was very angry. Ascribed to David 10,000, and to me they have ascribed only a handful. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? So Saul eyed David from that day forward.
All right. Underline in your Bible, end of verse 8. Now what more can he have but the kingdom? And Saul looked in verse 9 with suspicion from that day on. Okay. I have those hermeneutical notes that we taught you guys early on in residency. I have a pivot there in mind. This is where everything changes, okay? David has just finished his rocket ship ride, okay? We are right here. It's been great. The ride's been real. And at this point, it's going to start heading down. And we're going to see, as a result of Saul's jealousy, the result of his poor leadership, his ability not to handle well this situation, David's life is about to take a significant turn. Yeah, well.
I know that they don't get into the Mighty Men until like Kings and Chronicles, but since being that he's like 15 years old, does he start acquiring Mighty Men like at this point in time?
No, we'll see it actually here. We'll see him in 1 Sam 22 or 23. David will begin to surround himself with guys that will become that. The description of them is not here, it's later, but no. In fact, it's a fascinating piece of the story of when God brings them in. So yeah, we'll get there, okay? Talk to me about Saul. Make some leadership observations for me. How does Saul do around gifted individuals that are more gifted than himself?
It's jealous.
Yep, jealousy, okay? You guys ever seen that? Like people that just can't handle people around them that are more talented and more gifted than them? That is a horrible leadership quality, by the way. Okay, if you are an individual that leads that way and you've got to be the best person on the team, you've got to have all the attention, you need your name in the paper the next day, you need the credit, you need to be the one that came up with a great idea and executed the plan, right, and did it all, that's going to be a very lonely existence. John Maxwell, who's a great leadership author, talks about the ability of attracting other leaders. Leaders like that, that are threes and fours, they may be decent leaders, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, but they're only going to attract levels of leaders that are there or below them, okay? Someone with that type of quality, like David, is never going to want to be around a three or four leader if you're an eight or a nine leader. They're just not energized by that, and they're not given room to fly, if you will, okay? One of the things that great leaders, one of the things that secure leaders can do is say, that person is amazing. I want to bring them in. I want to develop them, and I want to let God use them however their gifting and the wiring there is, which means that person is probably better at that job than me, and it's going to get better results. It's going to get done with more excellence, whatever it may be, and can do that and can handle that. So think about that in your own leadership. That is one of the greatest tragedies of Saul's life. He cannot handle people around them, around him that don't get, if he gets, doesn't get the credit, if you will, okay? It's a poor, poor leadership quality, okay? And it's this specifically when they, you know, open up the Fresno Bee and Saul gets his name and, you know, kind of put in the back page and David's the guy in the front cover with the picture holding a shield and waving to everybody that everyone's praising him. He cannot handle that, okay? Something else I want you to notice about Saul, his mind shift from this point forward is going to shift. And instead of focusing externally and being a king and leading the nation and putting down the Philistines and raising up the temperature spiritually of the nation, what is Saul going to concern himself with? David. He's insecure and he's fearful. And the decisions that he's going to make from this point forward are going to revolve around fear and insecurity. When we make decisions as individuals, as leaders in our lives, whether it be significant places of business or just our personal, whatever it is, when fear and or insecurity drive those, they generally end up as very poor decisions, okay? Very rarely where you see somebody make decisions out of those motives that end up well. And you're going to see a train wreck coming for Saul and his kingdom because he cannot get his focus off David, okay? And it really ruins his leadership. So at this point, chapter 18, verse 9, everything changes, okay? Now, verse 10, let's see how bad it gets.
"And it happened on the next day that the distressing spirit from God came upon Saul, and he prophesied in his house. So David played the music with his hands, and as at other times, but there was no spear. There was a spear in Saul's hand."
All right, so you're seeing the same repeated action with David, right? So he's in Saul's kingdom, he's his armor bearer, he's going out to do battle. But what else is he doing? Why was he originally brought in?
Pandora.
Yeah, play Pandora for me. Comfort me in my time of need, okay? God has not relented on Saul. The evil spirit is still present, and God is using this. Again, this is not accidental. God needs to shape and mold David, and he has a vehicle through which he's going to do it, and this is the plan. So Saul's going to be the instrument to execute that plan. God has this whole thing in mind, is what he's going to do and why he's going to do it, but this is what's coming. So he, as usual, has been, again, you see the continual faithfulness with David, even in the midst of working underneath this awful boss. Saul now has a spear in his hand, verse 11. "Saul hurled the spear, for he thought, I will pin David to the wall." Okay, that's bad. When you go to work and they're, you know, you almost get killed by your boss, that's a bad day. Notice, not once, but, end of verse 11, twice. Like, okay. Maybe he just flinched and had a muscle spasm and accidentally threw the spear at me. Apparently, in this situation, it happens again. And David realizes, oh, man, I think I'm going to go take an early lunch and not come back for the rest of the afternoon. This is a bad, bad day, right? Verse 12, now you see again this motive that we're seeing in Saul. Read that.
"Now Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with him, but he had departed from Saul."
Isn't that a fascinating, like, why does Saul have anything to fear in David, right? He fears not, like, he's not afraid for his life. He's afraid of his reputation. He's afraid what David's going to become, and he wants to put that down. It's a bad, bad spot for him to be in. So, again, Saul's insecurity on the rise, Saul's fear and his horrible leadership, and this is kind of going to be the MO between these two for a long time. So, therefore, Saul removed him from his presence, appointed him as the commander of thousands, and he went out before the people. So what's Saul's game plan apparently moving forward? He kicks him out of the palace, if you will, and he puts him out before the people. What does that mean? As commander of thousands. Mm-hmm. What else? What's Saul thinking? Yeah. You know what? I'll just let kind of natural selection take care of this. He'll be a general. He'll go out. He's going to fight wars. He can't keep up the streak of perfection for forever, right? I just need one bad day, and then he'll die in the battle lines. Okay, the problem is verse 14.
And David behaved wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. Therefore, Saul saw that that he behaved very wisely and was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he went out and came in before them.
Man, so Saul's plan completely backfires. He's hoping that he's going to find some type of adversity. The problem is God said, this is the next king. Can David die? No. And you're just, man, you're trying to, just like we saw in the book of Acts, we're going to ramp up the difficulty in the lives of Christians. And what happens? When suffering and difficulty come, what happens to the church? Man, it explodes in growth. David sees adversity in his life, and what happens? Dude, God is just blessing this guy right now. People love him. He's prospering everywhere he goes. Saul can't stand him, but all of Judah and Israel loved David. And he went out and came in before them. So, man, every day he comes in and his name's in the paper and the people love him. By the way, did you see the geographical divide in verse 16? Judah in the south and Israel. It's becoming now, you're seeing that tendency because of the geography for there to be two different regions. And that's going to become a bigger issue trying to unite these folks, okay? So unite this kingdom again, right? So we're seeing kind of the handwriting on the wall. So it's taken a turn. Nothing's happened as of yet, but David's rocket ship ride is over. 17 now, remember this. What was David promised when he beat Goliath? A daughter, Saul's daughter specifically, or a wife. Okay, 17, here it comes.
And Saul said to David, here is my older daughter, Mirabeth. And I will give her to you as wife. Only be valiant for me and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul thought, let my hand not be against him, but let the hand of the Philistines be against him.
All right, so, hey, I promise you, my daughter, sorry, I forgot about that conveniently, and now he's finally got a plan of, okay, you can have my daughter, but there's a string attached to it. He's going to say, you're going to need to go collect some, basically, heads or foreskins for me, okay? I need a dowry, verse 25, of 100 foreskins of the Philistines. That is payment, okay? This is like Samson-esque, right? Like, David's going to have to go pay in the lives of defeated Philistines, okay? And again, why that was the prize, I don't know. So pick something different, maybe a pinky finger or whatever. But anyway, so that's what Saul wants. That's what Saul's going to get. Now, notice 18. This is David's response to this. Look at 18:18.
So David said to Saul, who am I and what is my life for my father's family in Israel that I should be a son-in-law to the king?
Okay, what does that mean?
It's like a humble response.
Yeah, there's definitely some humility there, right? Who am I that I should be a son of the king? Now, do you think David's like real eager right now to be in this family? Like, he already works for this guy who's a knucklehead. Do you think he wants that to be his father-in-law? You know, it's a bit of a dicey situation. But he's not going to refuse. But I think there is some genuine humility in David's response, okay? It came about in time when Merab, Saul's daughter, should have been given to David, that she was given to Adriel, the Mahalathite, for a wife. Okay, so takes a different route. This gal is given to somebody else. And I think David, in verse 20, had his eye on this gal, Saul's younger daughter, Michal, the whole time. Michal, Saul's daughter, loved David when they were told to Saul this thing was agreeable. Hey, sorry you didn't get my firstborn, which is fine with Saul, as long as he got to marry her off first. Now David is interested in Michal and vice versa. And Saul says, okay, she's going to come, become a snare to him. So Saul apparently knows something about Michal that isn't great and realizes, man, this is perfect, okay? I get to keep my promise. And Saul's thinking, Michael's not going to be this godly, wonderful wife to David. There's an issue here. So they go back and forth on this agreement, basically saying that's what David or Saul requires of Michal to be his wife. He needs now, in verse 25 again, 100 foreskins of the Philistines. Okay, 26 now. Watch how David responds to this agreement.
So when his servants told David these words, it pleased David well to become the king's son-in-law. Now the days had not expired. Therefore David arose and went, he and all his men, and killed 200 men of the Philistines, and David brought their foreskins and they gave them in full count to the king, that he might become the king, his son-in-law. Then Saul gave him Michal, his daughter, as a wife.
All right, so he asked for 100. How many does Saul get?
200.
Okay, so I'll up your ante a little bit. Okay, and again, 22 and following, or 21 and following that we missed, you see some, again, there is genuine humility in this is a big deal. David recognizes, even though Saul is kind of a chump, this is a big deal to be the son-in-law of a king, and he takes that very seriously. So he takes out his men, goes to battle. Verse 28, when Saul saw that and knew that the Lord was with David and that Michal, Saul's daughter, loved him, Saul was even more afraid of David. Thus, Saul was David's enemy continually. So he's intimidated, thinking this is going to kill David. That was his plan, and it completely backfires again, and ends up with now getting Michal, and he's not dead. Understand?
Why does it say that Saul knew that Michal would be that the hand of the Philistines would be against him because of this?
I think the idea with the foreskins, like if that's the agreement on getting a wife, then surely having to go kill 100 Philistines, he's going to die in that process. So again, he tries to ramp up the difficulty. God uses this as a blessing. David is now continuing to show his battle prowess, show his the men that he leads and their allegiance to him are pretty fascinating. So he wins the day and is celebrated again. And what does that create, by the way, in verse 29 with Saul? There's just more fear, right? This is everything Saul's trying to execute here is backfiring. And again, this is his motivation. How do I get David gone? How do I kill him? How do I get him out of my kingdom? How do I rid myself of this problem? What's Saul's end game, by the way? Why does he want this?
So he has no challenge.
Okay? It's not completely selfish, though it's mostly selfish. Yeah. What's he thinking about? Dude, I want a dynasty, right? I want my son king, not this redheaded, pale-faced, freckled kid from Bethlehem. Like, this is not who I want. I have a son. He's been doing battle. He's been here a lot longer. Like, this is the guy that I want in the king, right? I want to go bounce my grandkids on my knee, and I want to, you know, with that came a lifestyle and everything that came with it. That would have been beneficial to Saul, and there's a bit of maybe a true, genuine desire for his son in a good way to be king, okay? But that's just not what God said. God said, plain as day, your kingdom will be torn from you. It's going to be given to another. This is not God's plan. And Saul is fighting tooth and nail to execute the opposite of God's plan. That tends to not work very well, by the way, right? I don't know, in your life, when you're walking against full grain the will of God, that usually ends up poorly in my life. So Saul's going to give it a go, and we'll see how that ends up, okay? Verse 30, the commanders of the Philistines went out to do battle, as it happened as often as they went out. David behaved himself more wisely than all the servants of Saul, so his name was highly esteemed. Again, he is continuing to move up and up and up in this kingdom. So he's still seeing the benefits of what's happening at the hand of God, but Saul's attitude is very clearly changed with David. Okay? Now, 19:1, let's pick up there. All right, so now what's Saul doing? This is no longer what? Like a private plan. What is he offered or told his servants to do? We're going to kill him. Everyone's going to kill him. And now Jonathan's caught wind of this. Like, okay, my dad's not screwing around. He wants this guy dead. Jonathan now comes to David because of their relationship and says, listen, my dad wants you dead. Therefore, you need to be on guard. Morning. And stay in a secret place and hide yourself. Like, you need to be out of Dodge, like, today. It's going to get bad. I will go out and stand at the side of my father in the field where you are, and I will speak to my father about you. Man, I'm going to try to right this wrong, basically. So Jonathan says, I'm going to go to bat for you in front of my dad. We'll see how this ends up. Jonathan does so. In verse 4, this is the conversation he has with his pops. He says, do not let the king, dad, you, sin against his servant David, since he has not sinned against you. And since his deeds have been very beneficial to you, right? Isn't that a great testimony to have someone else say about you? Dude, he's done nothing wrong in your presence. He's not sinned against you. Everything that he's done, Dad, has been great and has only benefited you and this kingdom, right? Verse 5, keep going.
For he for he took his life in his hands and killed the Philistine, and the Lord brought about a great deliverance of all Israel. You saw and rejoiced. Why then will you sin against innocent blood to kill David without a cause?
All right. So I mean, this is a very logical conclusion. Like, look, man, he won the day. Israel rejoiced. This was good for you, good for Israel. Why do you want this guy dead? This doesn't make any logical sense. Now, Jonathan knows. Saul knows, okay, so he knows exactly why he wants him dead. But six, look what happens.
So Saul heeded the voice of Jonathan, and Saul swore, as the Lord lives, he shall not be killed.
All right, that's good news, okay? We're taking down his poster, you know, the wanted poster. We'll throw that in the trash for now, right? He's got extra copies of it he's going to put back up in a little bit. But he listens to the voice of his son. Okay, that makes sense. So in this moment, he responds, but this is going to be very short-lived, okay? Jonathan calls David in 7, says, hey, man, we're good. I went to bat for you. My dad has kind of called off the hounds, if you will. And David now comes back into Saul's presence as he was formerly. So comes back and becomes his harp player, his armor bearer. And they're good, at least for the time being. Okay? Verse 8, keep going.
And there was war again, and David went out and fought against the Philistines and struck them with a mighty blow, and they fled from him. Now the distressing spirit of from the Lord came upon Saul as he sat in his house with his spear in his hand. And David was playing the music with his hand. Then Saul sought to pin David to the wall with the spear, but he slipped away from Saul's presence and he drove the spear into the wall. So David fled and escaped that night.
Okay, now this is getting a little bit more serious. So in 18, we see David's attitude, or Saul's attitude about David, change. Okay, maybe this is kind of a slow turn, okay? But here, we see now something that we've seen before in the text, in chapter 19, verse 11. What is that? What's happened? Sorry, 10.
He tried to pin David again.
Again, right? This is now the third time, correct? Twice before with the spear, and now the third time David realizes, man, this is not a good situation, okay? David now flees and escapes that night. Now you're going to see God now take David on a very intentional journey. Okay, we're going to see David get stripped of five things kind of throughout this season of his life. He's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 17 at this point. This season right now, this season of kind of fleeing and running and being on the run from Saul, how long would you guess that's going to last? Yeah, till Saul's dead, okay? Which is 13 years. This journey is going to go like this until it hits here. David's going to be 30 years old when Saul dies at the end of 1 Samuel until this season of his life ends. And it literally is just as fast as the rocket ship went down, man, it ran out of gas and gravity took over, and it's going to go more or less straight down, okay? So what do you see? David is now... situation has changed. This isn't like, hey, are we good? Are we not good? Are you going to throw a spear at me again? He's realized this is bad. So if you were to talk about in verse 10, what has David lost at this point?
His job.
He's lost his job, right? I mean, he's no longer in the kingdom. He's no longer feeling the benefits of getting to eat at the king's table and all the stuff that comes with being the commander and that lifestyle and a house and whatever. He's lost his position in Saul's kingdom. So that's the first thing that we're going to see David lose. Okay, so call it what you like, but God is going to take now David through a very specific refining process, if you will. Okay, verse 11 now. Let's see this story unfold now with his bride.
Saul also sent messengers to David's house to watch him and to kill him in the morning. And Michael...
Dude, now that's dirty, right? We're going to send people to your house, we're going to spy on you, and then we're going to kill you at daybreak. So that's ugly. Okay, Michael finds out about it. Now, this is probably the first and only decent thing this woman does in all of David's life.
And Michael, David's wife, told him, saying, if you do not save your life tonight, tomorrow you will be killed. So Michael let David down through the window, and he went and fled and escaped. And Michael.
So who foils this plan? Michael, I mean, can you imagine waking up to that? Hey, David, my dad wants you dead. Yeah, I'm worried about it, right? No. He's coming, and he's coming tonight to kill you in your sleep. Like, I mean, emotionally, just dealing with the reality of that. Like you need to leave. Okay, no, you need to leave now in secret and lets him out through a window. Doesn't even leave the door because people are watching his home. Michael took the household idol. Ding, 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 ding. That should send off bells and whistles to you. Laid it on the bed, put a quilt of goat's hair on its head and covered it with clothes. When Saul and his messengers came to take David, she said, he is sick. Saul sent messengers in verse 15 saying, man, I don't care if he's sick. Bring his bed with him in it to me. Like, we're going to put him to death here. I mean, he is not messing around. When the messengers came again in verse 16, household idol was on the bed with the quilt of goat's hair on the head. So Saul said to Michael, why have you deceived me like this and let my enemy go so that he has escaped? And Michael's response was, he said to me, let me go. Why should I put you to death? So Michael, in the presence of her dad, who's, man, red hot mad and there's flames in his eyes, says, why did you do this? And what is her answer? He threatened me. It wasn't my fault. Okay. Now, she saves his life, so I'll give her a pass. So that was a great move. She lies probably to save face with her dad and probably not to get the wrath of Pops on her as well. So, yeah, Eric. Other than she's an idol worshiper, where did she learn that? Where would you suppose?
Mom.
How about in her house? Like, how about the home that she grew up in? How serious does Saul seem about walking with God right now? Where's the ark? Where's the tabernacle? Where's prayer? Where's, I mean, have you seen God's name mentioned other than in David's life and him prospering David in Saul's life at all? Like, it's absent. I mean, there's, so it tells you a lot about probably the home she grew up in.
Does it ever get into Saul? Like, does he have multiple wives? Or?
Yes, he does. Yeah, I don't know if it gets into a ton. There's probably a lineage somewhere, but I don't know that I know them all. So he's going to mention one of them here in a minute, Jonathan's mother. Not in a very positive way, but that's coming. Okay. David and Michael will be reunited. Okay, but they never ever live in peace again. Okay, this is a pretty from everything we see on the outside, this is a very dysfunctional relationship. It is not healthy. It's not good. David's going to have multiple wives as well. Part of him he'll acquire during this downward season in his life. But he's on the run now. He's out. So if you were to kind of take the second thing and say, here, what else now has he lost?
His wife.
I mean, he lost his wife, right? That's a big deal. I mean, like her or not, she at least saved your life. She loves you enough to stand up to her dad, who's, you know, she's afraid of her own life at this point. That's pretty significant. So he's lost his job. He's lost his wife. This is not a good start at this point. Now, David's kidless at this point, obviously, because of his age. So, I mean, that's family. Where's the rest of his family right now? Living in Bethlehem, right where they're from. So he's alone at this point, okay? Now, watch how David responds. If you're David and you just got kicked out of Saul's kingdom, okay? You lost your wife, you've lost your job, your family's in Bethlehem. Where are you going to go? Who would you turn to next? Who do you trust right now?
John.
Okay, Jonathan would be on that list. He's coming. Who's been in your life as a father figure for a long time at least? Maybe not long, but Samuel. Okay, watch where he goes next. 18.
So David fled and escaped and went to Samuel in Ramah and told him all that Saul had done to him. And he said, he and Samuel went and stayed in
Naoth. Yeah. Now, we don't get a ton of detail on this, but why is David going to Samuel? And what happens with these two? Yeah. I mean, trust this guy, anoints him. What do you think they share? What do you think David's doing at this point? Right? Just, there it is. Like, what, you okay? That was my back the truck up. I'm vomiting my life on you. You okay? Take it easy. Gary, it's okay. Take a drink of water. It's going to be fine. He's vomiting his emotional spewage upon him. Okay?
Like, straight up vomited just now. That was great.
I got that gift. There you go. Wow. Anyway, glad you're impressed with it. We're disgusted by it, one of the two. Anyway, What do you think Samuel's doing right now for David? Perspective, protection, speaking into his world a little bit. Let's raise the bar. Let's talk about what God's doing, right? So he's getting probably great counsel from Samuel. I'm sure David is listening to Samuel's own difficulties in his life and what he's walked through and how God's been faithful. Again, are you seeing a pattern here with David? Like, he's, instead of running and being alone, where does he go? He's going to go to a person that he loves and trusts, and that's not going to stop with Samuel, okay? Now, Samuel, because it's found out, verse 19, Saul was told, behold, David is in Naoth, in Ramah, with Samuel. Like, they got found out, so people somehow found out that, and Saul's going to continually be like a half step in front of David with, you know, he's got like eyes everywhere and ears everywhere. He finds out. So this isn't a safe place. Saul sends messengers to take David. And this funny story transpires here to follow. But David's got to run now from Samuel because Saul finds out about that. So this place of comfort that he has is quickly going to change. This is kind of a funny story. Watch what happens in verse 20. As Saul sends this cohort of messengers to take David. All right, so Samuel's leading like a group of prophets, and they're prophesying, which at this point is like an ecstatic, verbal, external utterance. The messengers come up, see Samuel doing this. What happens to the messengers? They all turn in the prophets as well, right? And they're like ecstatic utterances or whatever. Okay, what's the purpose of that? What's God doing? They've come to take David, and they stop and like are in like this trance, you know? It's bizarre, okay? So they prophesized when it was told to Saul in verse 21. He sends a second group. Same thing happens. Saul then sends a third group, and the same thing happens. So God is going to deliver David however Saul wants, or God wants to deliver David from Saul. So humorous that that's how it happens. And, you know, that's the picture that we're seeing there. Funny story, okay? Then he himself went to Ramah. This is Samuel here. And he came as far as the large well at Sikiu and asked and said, where are Samuel and David? And someone said, behold, they are in Naoth and Ramah. He proceeded there to go get him. Now, this is Saul personally. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him also, said that he went along prophesying continually until he went to Naoth and Ramah. So he ups the ante now. God does with Saul. Verse 24, this is really funny. Right. So the last time this has happened to Saul was when he was going to chase his lost donkeys. But, you know, now it happens again in verse 24. Literally lays down naked, looks like a fool, and is prophesying. So God is, again, man, he can hit the e-brake however he wants to, and he's going to do it this way. Chapter 20, verse 1, David fled from Naoth and Ramah and came to Jonathan. Okay, so what happens here with Saul, with Samuel, and with David? They've got to part ways, right? So what else has David lost?
Yeah, his mentor, you know, the prophet. If there's anyone that can say, hey, David, here's what's going on, here's what's happening, here's what God is doing, it would be Samuel. So he's lost now a significant mentor in his life, his spiritual authority, right? I mean, this is tough. So, and again, chapter 20, verse 1, where does David go next?
People, Jonathan, who do I trust? David is not fleeing from people, and I like that. Now, what's the downside of that? What do you think God's trying to do with David?
Doesn't seem like David's turning directly to God.
You don't see David turning to God. You see David turning to people. It isn't necessarily bad, so long as you're turning to God in the process. But we don't see that in David. So these people then are really a what? Man, they're temporary and they're kind of a crutch. They're an excuse for you not to deal with me. So what is God doing? If these are crutches in his life, what's God doing? He's just kicking out one from the other. You lost your job and your position. Okay. You going to turn to me? No. How about your wife? How about you lose her? Not yet? Okay. How about Samuel? How about I remove the godly influence in your life? Kick that out from underneath you. How about Jonathan? I mean, you can see where this is going, right? He's about to lose his best friend, his guy that he's made now a covenant with, and we're going to see the details of that here in chapter 20. It's significant, okay? So he flees and gets to Jonathan, chapter 20, verse 1. Let's pick up there.
Then David fled from Naoth in Ramah and said to Jonathan, "What have I done? What is my iniquity and what is my sin before your father that he seeks my life?"
Now stop there for a second, and let's talk about this, okay? You see this trajectory of David's life, right? How is he doing on this rocket ship ride up? As you looked at the internals in his life, do you have any reason to believe that this is something that is a self-inflicted gunshot wound? David deserved this? Sin in his life?
No.
I mean, so is he asking a very logical question? Like, what the heck? Like, what have I done to deserve this? Like, I am innocent. My hands are clean, right? Like, I don't get what's going on. How do you think David's doing emotionally at this point? Man, it is not good, right? His reserve tank is on low. He's got a bit left, but boy, it is getting ugly. You guys have all been in seasons like that where you're like, man, life just shifted and it wasn't for the good, and I don't know why, and all of a sudden, like when it rains, it pours, mentality has taken over and everything seems to go wrong. And you have no idea why. There's no rhyme or reason for it. And David's looking at Jonathan saying, man, explain this to me. Like, what have I done? And you're going to see in verse 3, like, how emotionally draining this would be. Keep going in 2. This is Jonathan's advice, or his word to David.
So Jonathan said to him, "By no means you shall not die. Indeed, my father will do nothing either great or small without first telling me. And why should my father hide this thing from me? It is not so."
Okay, so what does Jonathan say? Dude, I got the inside track. I know what's going on, and you're my friend. Okay, I will communicate to you whatever's going on with my dad. You can trust me, okay? There's not a long list of people in David's life that he has that type of relationship with, okay? He just lost Samuel. He just lost his wife, Michael, who, you know, there was probably some level of trust there. He does not have people, right? And these are the people that he has, and God's removing them. Now, verse 3, keep going. Look at David's response and just think through this through a very real and emotional lens.
And David took an oath again and said, "Your father certainly knows that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said, 'Do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved.' But truly, as the Lord lives, and as your soul lives, there is but a step between me and death."
That's an emotionally hard place to be. There is hardly a step between me and death. I mean, it's one thing to be in difficulty and trying to figure out how to pay the bills or circumstantially trying to figure out how to get a job or whatever it may be. He's at a point where David's not sure if he's going to be alive at this point tomorrow. That's a whole different level of emotional and spiritual turmoil. You see what God's doing with him. He is breaking him, and he's taking David to the end of his rope. You can't fix this, David. This is not something that you can do in your own power or change the circumstances or pick up the phone and make a call or bail your own way out of this. You can't do it. And this is God's plan. This is his purpose with David. Again, stripping him of everything that he knows. Okay. Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you say, I will do it." Okay. So David said to Jonathan, "Behold, there's a festival tomorrow, the new moon festival." It's talked about in the book of Numbers. And it was a monthly thing where they would celebrate the coming of the moon or whatever. Okay. And he says, "Hey, I'm going to miss, and I need to find out if Saul is truly ticked at me. I should be at dinner with you and Saul and the rest of the homies. I'm not going to go, okay? And depending on Saul's reaction, I'm going to know if this relationship is actually mendable or not, okay?" So he says, "Jonathan, tell him that I left to go home to Bethlehem to celebrate the new moon festival with my family, that I asked leave of you, and you gave me leave, okay? And let's see how he responds, okay?" That's kind of their agreement, okay? And if verse 7, David, if Saul says, "Hey, it is good, your servant shall be safe, but if he's very angry, then we will know that he's decided on evil." So if Saul wigs out about this, it's bad. If it's, you know, his response is good, then we'll know that, man, we're all good, okay? Jonathan reassures David, "Look, buddy, I'm on your team, we're all good. I'm not going to turn on you. He agrees to this. And they kind of work out the details of the plan that we'll get to in a second. Okay. Before they part ways, okay, in verse 14, Jonathan now reiterates this covenant, brings this language back up to David and gets more specific this time, at least for us. It may have been included the first time between the two of them, but in 14 and 15 now, we see a different level of commitment with this covenant, okay? 14 through 16. Somebody pick up there. All right, so 14, Jonathan says, if I am still alive, will you not show me loving kindness of the Lord that I may not die? Okay, what is Jonathan speaking to in the future? He knows there's a day coming that what's going to happen? David's going to be king, okay? And what's Jonathan's role going to be? Not king, right? Now, in a normal king situation, we haven't seen any in, obviously, Israel, because Saul's our first king. If you're the king and you've got a line of kids, right, and another lineage, another dynasty takes over, okay, and they become the kingly line, what does this line tend to do with the former line and all the males in that line? Kill them all, right? Why? You don't want competition. You don't want a coup. You don't want someone to raise up generations later and say, man, I'm from so-and-so. You all remember him. We had the rightful line to the throne. These guys were chumps and took over. So you just kill them all, okay? Makes it very easy, right? You guys remember Abimelech? Gideon's son? I'm going to kill all my brothers. Anybody else want to be king? Oh, you're all dead. Okay, I'll take the job. Thank you very much, right? That's the idea. Now, that's very pagan, but that's what Jonathan feared. If David has the power, not feared per se, but he just realizes, look, I'm a nobody to you at this point. So he says, if I'm still alive, will you not show me the loving kindness? What word is that in the Hebrew? I'm a failure. Hesed, right? That is one of the most important Hebrew words, right? Loving kindness, unmerited favor, grace is what he's asking for. I'm asking you to give me what I have not earned and I do not deserve. Okay, give me grace if I'm still alive. Okay, 15, he expands on that. You shall not cut off your loving kindness from my house forever, not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. So what else is Jonathan asking for? I need you to keep my line safe, not just me, but my house. Just be gracious, okay? Don't kill us all, or just look upon us with favor, David. Okay, when you're king and you've got the job, just be gracious to me and be gracious to my family. Okay, so Jonathan made a covenant, literally cut a covenant. Same language we see with God, cutting or enacting a covenant with his people, and may the Lord require it at the hands of David's enemies. Verse 17, Jonathan made David the vow again because of his love for him, because of his. He loved him as he loved his own life. And again, people have wrongly misconstrued this for what it's not saying. Jonathan has such an affection for David, an admiration for David, a love for David, a love for the Lord and God's plan for David, that his life, where God is taking David, is more important than his own, and he is willing to take a back seat and say, you're going to be the king. Now, we see hints of what this is doing between Saul and Jonathan in the text right before this. How does Saul think of his son Jonathan and his response to what David's doing and or what God's doing in David's life about David being king? Did I ask that correctly?
Yes.
He thinks he's an idiot. Like, why in the world would you accept this as truth? You're the prince. You're the next king. He's furious at Jonathan. We're going to see that in just a moment. For accepting this is like gospel truth, right? So he's not okay with that. Jonathan's like, man, no, there's a bigger plan. this is how it is. I realize that puts me on the outs. And Jonathan's willing to kind of swallow that pill and say, well, that is what it is. And I believe in David. So they made a covenant. They renew it. In 18 and following, this is kind of the story of the new moon festival and everything that's coming. So the next day, they go have this dinner. They hatch a plan that we'll see kind of unfold. David now in verse 24 does not show up to dinner. And the king says, man, what's going on? Okay, verse 26, the first night that he doesn't show up to dinner, Saul thought, you know what, he's probably unclean. He couldn't come to dinner because he's ceremonially unclean. Couldn't be at this festival, so he doesn't show up. The second night, however, was different. Okay, 27, pick up there, 20:27. All right, so that's the plan that they talked about. That's exactly what Jonathan communicates. Verse 30, look at Saul's reaction.
Then Saul's anger was aroused against Jonathan, and he said, you son of a perverse, rebellious woman.
Wow. That's your wife, by the way, Saul. You son of a perverse, rebellious woman. And we have an expression that's probably very similar to that. Okay? I don't need to say it, but can you see the anger in Saul? You son of a... he's speaking of his wife who's not dead, right? He's basically saying, your mother would be ashamed that she birthed you into this world because of your decisions right now. I cannot believe what I am hearing from you, okay? Saul is angry, okay? Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame into the shame of your mother's nakedness? Meaning, this was the reason for your birth. You are a prince, and you are choosing him over her, over me, over yourself. Like, you see this conflicted view of Saul. So how does Saul view the promise of Samuel in 1 Samuel 15 regarding his throne and being stripped from him? Like, over my dead body, you're going to take the throne out of my hands. And literally, that's exactly how we're going to take it out of Saul's hands, over his dead body. So he's not in agreement with this, and he is going to do everything in his power to keep his spot on the throne and to keep his lineage secure, okay, to the point of calling his son, what did he just call his son, okay? Verse 31 now, he expands. So you clearly see Saul's motives, right? As long as David's alive, your throne's not going to be established. Jonathan, I really don't care what you want. I want what I want, and you're going to be the freaking king. That's basically what Saul's saying. So the only way that that's going to happen, that we can know that's going to happen, is what? What do we have to do? Kill David. That is my life's mission from this point moving forward, okay? David must die. 32. Now, this was a really poor timing, okay? This is when you keep your mouth shut and you don't say anything because your dad is past the point of rational thinking. He is hot, angry. So he's like, man, why should he? What has he done? Like, he probably said it with a little bit of grit to it. 33, this is insane. Where is Saul mentally? Hawes, read that. Dave, you got that? 20:33? Will you read that for me? Sorry.
You're just saying, Eric made a good point. Why does he always have a spear?
Seriously, yeah. Man, the guy's packing all the time. Careful with guys that have spears all the time. They're dangerous.
20:33.
Please.
But Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him. So Jonathan knew that his father was determined to put David to death.
I mean, we've had three times with this with David. What does he do to his own son? Like, I want you to be king, but I'm going to run a spear through you right now. Like, he is completely off his rocker. He's not thinking straight. So, yeah, and I guess that would be pretty clear. And Jonathan realized, you know, what does it say? That his father decided to put David to death. Like, by trying to kill me, he realizes he really doesn't want to kill David. Okay? Yeah. Thankfully, he's not a good aim. So, yes, he's got lots of spears, but they're not real effective. So, there you go. So, you're there at the dinner table, man. I don't know. Maybe it just takes time to get your spear out, and Jonathan's ducking at this point. I don't know. So, but bad deal. So, he's a bad shot. So, thankfully, or we'd have a lot of dead people around. Or maybe there's other people that just got shot at the table. I don't know. So, oh, sorry about that, buddy. I was trying to kill my son. My bad. All right. 34 now, Jonathan is going to be loyal to his word, and now he's going to communicate to David based on the plan that they had hatched. David is hiding in a field. Jonathan's going out the next day to shoot arrows, and they kind of hatched a plan where David could hide and he could communicate to him. And basically, the gist of the chapter is Jonathan gives his, in verse 40, his arrow and his, or his bow at least, to the armor bearer. It says, take him to the city. 41, when the lad was gone, David arose from the south side, fell on his face to the ground, and bowed three times, and they kissed each other, wept together, but David wept the more. David, at this point, had gotten the news, this is not good, there is no reconciliation, my dad is, he's going to kill you. That's where we're at. And because of the actions that had transpired before this with the arrows and the shooting, David very, very clearly got this message, and he realizes, I'm done. I can't be here anymore. 42, watch what now Jonathan says. All right, so 2042, what else has David lost? He lost his best friend, right? That's a tough loss. Samuel's gone, Jonathan's gone. He's going to see Jonathan again, but it's going to be sparse. I think it's one more time he'll see him before Jonathan dies. This is rough. I mean, you're losing, again, I mean, pick whatever your crutches are. David is losing the things in his life that are the most important to him. God is systematically removing the things in his life that he wants to remove for whatever reason. And he just will not relent. He will not allow the situation to change until he gets David where he wants. Okay? Now, 21, you're going to begin to see how emotionally distraught, how unclear thinking at this point David is. It's rough, okay? 21:1, let's pick up there on the rest of this journey. So he's obviously having to flee. David is a man on the run with no home.
Now David came to Nob to Elimelech, the priest. And Elimelech was afraid when he met David and said to him, why are you alone and no one else is with you?
All right, so he goes to Nob. What's in Nob? Yeah, the tabernacle's in Nob, okay? Shiloh is where that ark is housed, but he goes to Nob, okay? And Ahimelech, who's the current high priest of the day, sees David coming. He's coming alone, okay? David normally, when he was out, would be with all his men, right? They're going to fight battles, and he sees him coming alone, which he sees is like, this is not good. Something's happening. Like, you coming here for me? Like, what's going on? Verse 2, this is what David says. What does David say?
He lies.
David's a guy that's got a lot of integrity, yes? You're at a pretty dark spot in your life when you think the only way out from this situation is to be dishonest and to bold-faced lie to the current high priest. Saul sent me on a mission. We're all good. It's secret. It's like, you know, SEAL Team 6 stuff, so don't worry about it, okay? My men are off doing their deal. You and I were just having a conversation here, okay? David is not in a good spot. Now, therefore, what do you have on hand? Okay, give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found. So I need food. So give me what you have. you're pretty desperate, right? When you don't, not only do you not have a house, you don't have food, you don't have water. I mean, you see how bad this is for David. Verse 4.
The priest answered David and said, there is no common bread on hand, but there is holy bread. If the young men have at least kept themselves from women.
All right, so he says, look, I don't have any food, but what do I have?
Holy bread.
I got consecrated bread, which is probably like the table of showbread, that type of stuff that would have been used in the temple or the tabernacle service. It's holy. When they take it out, it can be eaten. But what's the stipulation? Yeah, it's for priests or it's for people that have kept themselves from women. Like David's, man, David's got a wife. That's not his, that doesn't apply to him or doesn't, obviously that characteristic is not true of him. He's married. So verse 5, David answered and said to the priest, surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out on vessels of the young men who were holy. Though it was an ordinary journey, how much more when their vessels be holy? Like, this is a holy mission. Of course I've kept myself from women, as have my men. Like, you know that. So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread but the bread of the presence, which was removed from the Lord in order that the hot bread may be put in its place when taken away. So this goes down. David bold-faced lies to Ahimelech, right? And this guy has no reason to not believe David. Yeah, dude, you're one of the king's men. I know who you are. You're David in the newspaper. Like, I know exactly who you are. So they've got a relationship, and he lies to him. So Ahimelech now is, unbeknownst to him, what has this done with Ahimelech? Yeah, right? You think Saul's going to find out about this? Saul finds out about everything, right? Now, he's just put Ahimelech in a jam, a pretty significant jam. And David is going to see the repercussions of his sin in other people's lives. And this is tough. Now, here is how Saul finds about this. This guy may be, in verse 7, one of the most filthy people in your entire Bible. I can't stand this guy.
Verse 7?
Yes.
Now, a certain man of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and the name was
Doeg the Edomite. All right, so for whatever reason, this guy gets held up, and he's in Ahimelech's, like, company, whether he's trying to get clean from something or whatever, we don't know, but he happens to be in earshot, and he's loyal to Saul. He's on his staff. When David said all this to Ahimelech, Doeg is there and hears all of it. David said to Ahimelech, now, is there a spear or a sword on hand? For I brought neither sword nor spear nor weapons with me because the king's matter was urgent. Again, he's walking him through in even greater detail this lie. The priest said, by the way, what do I have? This is funny. First, not funny, but I guess coincidental.
So the priest said, the sword of Goliath, the Philistine whom you killed in the valley of Elah, there it is, wrapped in cloth behind the ephod. If you will take it, if you will take that, take it, for there is no other except that one here. And David said, there is none like it. Give it to me.
So David takes his old trusty sword that he used to chop off the head of Goliath that for whatever reason Ahimelech has now at the tabernacle and takes it with him. Okay, David arose and fled again from Saul that day. Again, you're seeing the theme in David's life. And he went to Achish, king of Gath. Where's Gath? Gath's on the coast. Gath is a Philistine city. So where's David running to? His enemies. Now, how bad is your life when you feel safer amongst your enemies than with your friends or in your hometown?
He does have a big sword now, though.
He does have a sword. And hopefully he's a better shot than Saul is with his spear. I mean, that's bad, gang. I mean, David's not going home. I don't know why he doesn't go to Bethlehem. Bethlehem is not far from Jerusalem. But for whatever reason, maybe he doesn't want to endanger his family. He literally has no one to turn to. So he goes to Achish, king of Gath. And it's about to get dark, dark in David's life. Okay? Verse 11.
And the servants of Achish said to him, is it not David the king of the land? Did they not sing to him to one another, dancing, saying, Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000?
Whoa. So David goes in like all covert, trying to, you know, find a place to hide. And what happens? Oh, hey, David, we've seen your face in the paper. We know who you are. You're the guy. You're the guy that they sing the songs about, right? Right, right. And they tell Achish. Now where's David? screwed is what he is, right? That's what he is. I mean, he's in a bad spot. Like, you just walked in your enemy's camp hoping you're going to, like, throw up your hoodie and be, like, all covert and just kind of blend. And what happens? Hey, there's David. We hate you. You killed all our people. So now what's going to happen? Let's kill him, right? I mean, that's the idea. So if you're David, what do? You act crazy. You make everybody believe, oh, wait, that's not David. Never mind. That's his doppelganger, right? Verse 13, man, how low has David gotten? And by the way, in verse 12, they greatly feared. David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. He realized the power that he had. This news has gotten all the way up the food chain to the head guy. And in 13, this is what he does. All right, so put that in Living Bible for me. What does David just do? He acts like a slobbering idiot, right? Like some type of madman. So he literally, his beard's grown out. He's slobbering all over himself. He's scratching at the gate. Like he's just acting like a fool. What has David lost at this point? His what? Integrity, his dignity. I mean, you call it whatever you want. Like you're willing to do anything. That's a pretty low spot, right? It's pride. I mean, call it what you want, dignity. He's been stripped pretty significantly. So when you're willing to feign madness, like you're some type of lunatic, in order to escape the wrath of what's coming, man, that's where David's at. He disguised his sanity, acted insanely in their hands. Verse 14, Achish buys it. Okay, he has a hilarious response. Tells you a little about the kingdom that he's running.
Then Achish said to his servants, look, you see that man? That man is insane. Why have you brought him? Why have you brought him to me? Have I need of a madman that you have brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? Shall this fellow come to my house?
Do I lack madman that you brought me yet another one? So it's like, look, I got plenty of issues to deal with. I don't need one more fool. So keep him, right? Keep him. So David is literally, I probably didn't draw it well enough. This should be here, okay? So David is at this point. He's hit rock bottom. He's lost his job, his wife, his mentor, his best friend, and now he's lost his dignity. And there's not a whole lot else that he can lose. Chapter 22, verse 1, we're going to see now where David flees. Okay, he's escaped Achish, king of Gath. He really hoped that would work out. It doesn't. So now he's got to run out of this town as well. 22:1. All right, so David now flees from Gath, goes back east. There's a location close to Azekah where David fought Goliath up in the Shephelah that's beginning to come into the Judah Mountains and the foothills called Adullam, okay? And is a gigantic cave system, underground cave system. So David goes and hides in caves. Amy, you were there. You remember these? Fascinating place, because you look across the scope of the land, it just looks like a normal, like, you know, field with some rocky terrain or whatever, and there are, Haas has been there and others, they're just endless caverns underground that you can go crawl through. Matt's going to be crawling through those in a couple days. We will go there. This is where David hid. Your life is pretty bad now when you are hiding underground alone. You have no source of water, no source of food. It's been so bad that you went to an enemy. This is a step really below that. David's life is at this point, it's horrible, horrible, horrible. And he's hiding now in caves, hoping for the best. Okay, now watch what God does in verse 2.
And everyone who was distressed, everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discouraged or discontented gathered to him, and he became a captain over them. And there were about 400.
So what does God do in this moment? Yeah, these are the lowly outcasts. Now, how do these people become lowly outcasts? If they're living in kind of Saul's kingdom, but exiles, what would you guess happened? Yeah, they're enemies of Saul. They got kicked out of the kingdom for one reason or another. So these guys probably aren't the most, like, you know, this is a ragtag. These are like pirates, man. These guys are a little shady. Something happened to get them kicked out of the kingdom. But there's 400 men. What do you see immediately, by the way, about David's personality? What type of guy is he?
Natural leader.
Yeah, guys just rally to him, right? He's in a bad spot, but, dude, when people see them, they go, man, I want to join forces with you. I want to link up with you. So now he's been obviously anointed king. That news is spread. They know who this guy is. They know he's a battle-hardened guy at this point in his life. But they rally to this guy. So he is, God has very graciously allowed men to kind of come in his life. He stripped them of David of other things, and he's bringing in now a ragtag group of people. Now, from this group and others, who are these people going to become? Will, you mentioned it earlier. These are the mighty men. Some of these guys are going to be the people that David's going to list 20, 30, 40 years from now is the guys in David's life that were steadfast and loyal and battled with David. And these guys are bad. I mean, they are, I can't believe we haven't made a movie about this. I mean, it is ridiculous, some of the lineage and legacy that these men have, okay? Now, verse 3, pick up there.
Then David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, "Please let my father and my mother come here with you till I know that the God that God will be will do for me."
All right, now where's Moab? East side of the Jordan. So David leaves the Shephelah, crosses over the Jordan, goes to the king of Moab. Who does Moab worship? Chemosh. Okay, this is not; these are not friends. Okay, they're. At times have been in enemies, and maybe David's, for whatever reason, I guess with battles, has a relationship with this guy enough to where he can go make a request, but it's still an odd request. And what does he ask? Dude, I need to get my family, like, out of the country, like, lest their lives are endangered. I mean, does that tell you a little bit about Saul and what he knows is coming? Like, man, this guy's a terrorist. Like, look, I'll put your brothers and your mom and your dad at gunpoint if I have to get you back. And David realizes, man, my family is not safe because of what's happening to me. And he says, can I hide them in Moab? Like, man, that's bad. Now, Ruth came from there during the season, right? We're just off the season of the judges. So maybe there's some ties in that. Well, David's going to cover that with you guys next week. So maybe there was some sort of relationship, but these are not friends per se. This is really an enemy nation. We've seen Israel go to battle with them, okay? So apparently that's what happens in verse 4. Watch where he goes now.
So he brought them before the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the stronghold.
Okay, he goes to a place called the stronghold. We don't know where that is. There's a place in Israel that's known as the stronghold. It's called Masada. It could be this place. We don't know for sure. Masada is a super famous site in terms of like recent history, turn of the century type history with Israel, which is recent for them, not recent for us. It doesn't show up in the text a ton, so it could be this place. But David's hiding basically in the Judah Mountains, and he's in the wilderness, not even the Judah Mountains, he's in the wilderness. Masada is maybe a mile or two west of the Dead Sea in the southern kind of portion of Israel. Very, very rocky terrain, and it's wilderness, it's miserable, it's desert, and that's where David has the opportunity to hide, okay? And there's springs out there and such that you can find water if need be, but it looks like him and his men have now gone out of Adullam and have chosen to hide here. The beauty of Masada is like it's this like pimple in a flat land all around it. So literally, you're on this high place, and you have a 360-degree view of everything around you, and you have the high ground everywhere. So it's a great place to hide if you can get water and those sorts of things to you. So not sure, but it looks like he's in that area. Coming out of Moab, this would have been a very natural spot to go hide. And as you look at the landscape, Masada is a very clear mountain. You're like, oh, yeah, there's other mountains around it, but this is the only one in that chain, and it's a great place to hide. Okay, so verse 5, the prophet Gad said to David, "Do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go now to the land of Judah." So David departed and went into the forest of Hareth. Judah would have been obviously the southern portion, also desert. Is told now to flee there again. So he's just, man, he's everywhere. So as soon as he finds out Saul's on to him and learns the location. He's got to flee, so he is all over the place. Okay, verse 6, let's pick up there.
When Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered, now Saul was staying in Gibeah under the tamarisk tree in Ramah, and his spear with his spear in his hand, and all his servants standing around.
Right, always, right? Always a spear. Good. That's a great observation. Saul said to his servants, "Now hear you Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give to you all the fields and vineyards? Will he make you commanders of thousands and ten thousands?" He's in Gibeah in Benjamin. Now where is Saul from? What tribe? Benjamites, right? So he's saying to the Benjamites, why haven't I heard about this? Why are you hiding David? Is David going to give you fields and stuff and vineyards and commanders? For all of you have conspired against me so that there is no one who discloses when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse, and there is none of you that is sorry for me or discloses to me when my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush until this day. Do you hear Saul's tone and his insecurity? Nobody's loyal to me. Everybody's this plot. Like he's a bit mad in the head and obviously insecure. So he's wondering why he's not gotten a report from the Gibeonites as to the location of David, or at least it's Jonathan conspiring against him, so he's going nuts, okay? And now, filthy McNasty Doag steps up in verse 9.
Then answered Doag the Edomite, who was set over the servants of Saul, and said, "I saw the son of Jesse going to Nob to Elimelech, the son of
Ahitub." So, oh yeah, I saw David. Now that you mention it, I was at Ahimelech's place, and he inquired of the Lord for provisions, and Ahimelech gave him provisions. Like, yeah, now that you mention it, Saul, I totally saw him, just like last week. King sent word to summon Ahimelech the priest, son of Ahitub. Saul says to him, "Listen now, son of Ahitub, like you just read that completely different now, right? You son of a perverse woman." And he said to him, "Here I am." Saul said to him, "Why have you, the son of Jesse, conspired against me and given him the bread and the sword and inquired of God for him so that he would rise up against me by laying in ambush this day?" So Ahimelech's like, what? Like, why am I here? Why have I conspired? Like, dude, you sent him on the secret mission, right? Ahimelech said, "And for who of your servants is more faithful than David, even the king's son-in-law who's captain over your army?" Like, dude, I know David. You know David. He's faithful. Did I just begin to inquire for God for him yesterday? Like, dude, Saul, I've been doing this forever. That's my job. Like, I inquire for all your men in your company. Like, this is what I do for you. I'm the high priest, right? Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or any of his household of my father. Your servant knows nothing of all that. Like, Saul, you're speaking crazy, dude. What are you talking about? So what has David now done to Ahimelech? He's in a jam. So how does it look to Saul? You're lying. You're conspiring with David. And Ahimelech's saying, I don't know what you're talking about, dude. He came, I gave him bread, I gave him a sword. And yeah, like I rubbed the magic eight ball and we talked about God's will. Like what in the world are you talking about? So David's sin's about to come back to haunt him. The king said, verse 16, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and your father's household." Like, buddy, relax, okay? Not good. Verse 17, keep reading.
Then the king said to the guards who stood around him, "Turn and kill the priests of the Lord, because their hand is also with David, and because they knew when he fled and did not tell me."
Wow. So what is Saul's answer? Kill Ahimelech and all his JV priests. Kill them all. Like, now, even Saul's men realize, dude, this is dirty. This is bad. The servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands to attack the priest of the Lord. Saul, buddy, you've gone too far. This is too much. Then the king said to Doag, the Edomite. Remember, he's an Edomite. He lives east of the river. You turn around and attack the priest. And Doag, the Edomite, turned and attacked the priest, and he killed 85 men who wore the linen ephod. This guy is dirty. Dirty that he'd be willing to do that. Okay, so we'll stop there for today. We'll pick up when I get back from Israel. Remember, Haas has got Ruth with you guys for the next couple weeks, so excited to hear about that. So I shall. We're going to have a lot of fun. So pray for us.
Don't throw up.
I'm going to plan on not doing that.